miles into Iraq on a daily basis. So they get a little angry when they say they're in Kuwait. And then the 148th currently is supporting the Air Force sovereignty missions. They get a hardship tour. They are in Hawaii. And as you see in the media, the Red Bulls have now just come back home with the last flight landing as we speak. So we're very, very proud of them. I should point out their performance has been excellent. And Admiral Mullen, chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, in public testimony, cited them as the model for the way we want the new divisions to operate in Iraq with the assist and advise type of missions. So we're very, very proud of that. Then we have, our units. I've talked about them, the two fighter wings. I should point out the other fighter wing, the 133rd, was on a training mission to Puerto Rico when a thing called an earthquake in Haiti occurred. And not known and not publicized, but over 50 missions were flown into Haiti by Minnesota Airframes. Uniqueness of it is they were all flown in at night, because apparently all the civilian aircraft don't fly at night, and that's the only time they could get in. So they were doing it in and out, dropping off the cargo. So there was a lot of operations and a large footprint of the Minnesota Air National Guard. Also, we have our 1st Brigade, the longest-serving brigade in Iraq, and right now, be prepared to have them go someplace in the near future. I'll just leave it at that, but we have what we call a patch chart, and they're on that chart, and they're programmed. It'll be a good year or so out, but they are programmed to go. Also, we have our other units doing very, very well. Camp Ripley is becoming, and you're seeing a number of things being developed there, but Camp Ripley is becoming a regional training site for the upper Midwest, and we're very, very proud of that. We've invested a lot of money and are going to be investing. We have been investing federal dollars into Camp Ripley that's quite significant, which has been a stimulus, if you will, to the area in there. If anyone knows Breitbach Construction, they owe you a thank you. The federal good. But also what I'm very proud of is our community mission. And on page 20, you'll see an outreach. The engineer units that are stationed in Camp Ripley had spent a year in Iraq reconstructing as many things. For example, you may not have known, but there's a number of U.S. soldiers that were electrocuted in showers. The Minnesota National Guard went in and ripped all that stuff out and replaced it and fixed it up and got it to standard. The difference between a third world subcontractor and a Minnesota National Guardsman. They came back home and being trained and used to this. The veterans camp, rest camp in up north of the cities here said, you know, we've got a lot of projects we could do. Could we kind of partner? And we said, yes, we would do that. It's good training for us at no cost to us because they provide all the supplies and material. We just provide the labor. They built two cabins and retrofitted or took care of about a half a dozen complaints that, you know, for cemented pads so that the dumpsters could be on them, things of those nature. What was most remarkable was the camping veterans there worked with Cub Food and so forth, arranged and grilled steaks and fed the troops lunch. It was they were just very, very proud. And the troops had such positive feedback and feeling that they were supposed to work two shifts. They said, no, we're all going to work one shift. So they did 12 to 14 hours a day. And they said, we would like to do that again. So we programmed that for this summer to continue to build those projects. So it's a win-win community effort that is a partnership with all agencies. Humanity, Habitat for Humanity, some projects we tried. I guess what I'm trying to say is, as a rule, each guardman is expected to contribute a minimum of 4 hours of community service time to help promote the things. When you take 170-person unit times 4 hours each, that's a lot of labor that we can help and assist with. Continuing on, page 22 talks about a concept that impacts you as senators, and it's called Fort Minnesota. A lot of times on the national level, we get pushback. You don't need this, you don't need that, because the feds provide it. Well, what they do is they provide it on their forts and posts throughout the country. If you were in Columbus, Georgia, you drove 10, 20 miles minimum or max, I would say, to go to Fort Benning to have all the facilities you would need. The returning active duty go back to Fort whatever and find all the facilities ready there. Well, we don't have that in Minnesota, so what we are doing and working with, and I'm going to talk as two things I would like this committee to focus on if they were so inclined, but in Fort Minnesota, we just don't drive 5 minutes somewhere. If a spouse needs to see a counselor because of some issues, they may have to drive 45, 50 miles. Now, you take the weather we have today, it doesn't cut it. So we're trying to make it so that we can work with the communities. We have some solutions, and I'll leave it at that. Connecting our deployment families, I think you're all familiar with our Serve Our Troops that do the steaks, dinners, and so forth. They've done a number of them, and we've been honored. They have been honored at the national level as the model for other states to look at. General McKinley purposely wanted them selected, so they had kind of an inside track to win the first award ever of his award. But he wanted that standard set extremely high. And now we'll be going out to D.C. later this month, my wife and I, and briefing all the other states and just how we did it, because that's the expectation. That's who we are. The two things I ask maybe to assistance on. First of all, this counseling aspect that we have, there's a program called CORE, and I'm not sure exactly the acronym, and I'm not going to try even guess it. But what we've done is working through the Department of Veterans Affairs, they working with Lutheran Social Service, has reached out to the communities that have counseling services available within proximity, and we enable our people in need to be able to go do that conveniently, confidentially, and it just works. We would like to see that continued. The other one is that we have a sunset clause that's coming due on our veterans centers at the state colleges and universities. That has been extremely successful with, I think, 90-plus percent of the colleges and universities in the state system actively involved in it. And we would like to see that continued. Why? Well, of the 1,000 that just came back from Iraq, 48% of them, and this is, by the way, the more mature, more already degreed people, but 48% of them says, we want to go back to school. And they've sat down and visited with the counselor and so forth. The university system, Minsky system in particular, has bent over backward to help us reintegrate our people. So I say with great pride, this is my seventh testimony on the Minnesota National Guard before this committee, and I'm proud to say we've come a long way. We're doing an awful lot of things. My commitment to you was to make sure that you had a National Guard you could be proud of, and I would like to think I've achieved that objective. So, subject to your question, sir.
Well, Major General, there's a couple of questions. The first one's going to be, are the enlistments? Are you able to keep up to full strength by?
Mr. Chair, we are. In fact, we are still probably the highest ranking state in the nation. We're at 115% Army, 106% Air. I will tell you, however, there is an interesting anomaly occurring right now, and that is, 2009 subtract 8 from 9, and you've got 2001. We all know what happened in 2001. A lot of people have been listening since then because of service. You know, it used to be education only. Now it's service. And now that flow chart is coming, and they've done their 8 years. Now, it used to be six. In fact, it is six with 2 years of inactive reserve. Well, the Army is so strapped that they've been pulling all those inactives in back to go with someone else. So most people have been hanging in there. So as they go through, we're now seeing, so the pipeline, we're able to sustain it. But what we're happening is we're seeing that natural turnover. And it's not a negative. It's what they agreed to do and so forth. But we find some bright young ones that we'd like to keep. So those are the things. So, but as far as strength's concerned, they're coming in. In fact, we've been told last year to cut back 600. We were that good.
Well, Major General, I'm going to ask you how the morale is. somebody promised me 3 years ago a bonus check and I didn't get it, I would, my morale would turn the other way.
Yeah, Roger,
and
that's
so I'm working on that. This committee is going to work on that. We're going to take care of that. Maybe we can't wait for big government to do everything, but that's not fair. It makes no sense.
Chair Rickerman, there's a number of issues. Trust me, compared to the federal government, you're good. But we are sincerely working on it. And the beauty of it is there's such a groundswell now that, for example, we have a
ADMRA.
MRA. I always get the R and the M switched around. That literally it's at Secretary Gates's level. I mean, they're just jumping through hoops. But this is something that goes back to 05, 06, 07 with the first BCT. We're finally getting that resolved. But also, I will say with the tax benefits and so forth that you've enacted this past session and so forth, yes, a bonus would be nice, but you have treated us well. I'll just leave it at that.
Well, Major General, if it keeps snowing every day like it is this year, you're going to be busy moving a lot of water in the spring because it's going to melt and it's going to start going good when it goes.
Yeah.
And that's all over. That's even my southern part of Minnesota. It never floods down there, but you never say never because it could do that. And it's certainly going to do that in the northern part of. So we got to count on somebody. And we will count on you because it's pretty hard to count on the fire department. Still do their share, but you really have to have somebody like you to do that.
Chair Beckerman, just for information, I told you the conference in Iowa, but also we had a representative from North Dakota in my office today also talking about this, and we're kind of coining it. Someone gave me the phrase. We're going to call it I lost it already. Oh. One flood, one fight. And what we're working is we're already trying to do some work to get the governor down there to meet with the Moorhead and the counties. They all came in and get them just to get their plans and being able to pre-position as much stock and equipment as we possibly can. But the caveat is we have to now, lesson learned from last year, is reach across the border because we sent over 300 people from Minnesota to support North Dakota last year. North Dakota needs our helicopters. They needed our bodies. The troops from West St. Paul did 3 aerial night insertions, 3 o'clock in the morning, landing by helicopter into water to sandbag. And that did not go unnoticed by others. So we're doing this, and we've learned our lesson. And again, when you couple that with the other two fronts that we think might be happening, we're definitely in that decision cycle of making sure things are going to happen correctly.
Any questions from the committee? Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Major General, for that wonderful report. I don't think there's anybody at this table that isn't tremendously proud of the work that you do and everybody under you. One of the questions that I was asked of me during all this midsummer here with the Red Bulls deployed, excuse me, I got a little bit of a cold here, being deployed, how many were on standby in Minnesota when that went? When they were deployed?
Senator Ingebrigtsen, Chair Spickerman, we had 2,253 at the max people, Army deployed during that time frame. Our strength in the Army is 13,500. So we were very, very fortunate. A state like North Dakota ran into trouble when they took their units over to Kosovo. They were short. That's why we supported North Dakota. Unfortunately, this flood fight, they're going to still be deployed in Kosovo. So that's why we're coordinating with North Dakota. But we have it pretty much designed so that we have 2 of the 136 in the northern part of the Red River. We have the engineers down by the southern part of the Minnesota, or northern part of the Minnesota River. You've got the 151 on the southern part of the Minnesota River going all the way. You got the armor net. So everyone's got their own sector. And what we're doing also is integrating and meshing with the Department of Homeland Security, Emergency Management, Chris Heide, to kind of link and make sure that all the COMO checks and everything else are in place and making it happen a lot easier. So, ironically, the technology has been listed as one of the villains of all of this. If one of the things I've noted in the 5 years, 6 years of going flooding, fighting floods, flying in there, this last flood fight, the water was drained off the farm fields extremely fast. GPS, sophisticated farm equipment, the ability to drain tile and get that water off the field as quickly as possible and into the river. So we don't have the holding ponds of old days, you know. And that was, remember they were talking about Southern Moorhead being a holding pond?
Yeah.
That didn't go very far,
not
did
very
it?
Well.
No. So those are all those technologies and things that we're doing. But we're monitoring. There's a meeting over at the federal building tomorrow where the Weather Bureau will be there, and we'll get the latest update on what's their long-range forecast. 3 weeks ago, it was 55% probability. Now it's 83% probability. So we're getting there.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, and we'll keep moving right along.
Just a tremendous.
Now we're going to hear from Don Pfeiffer, I believe his name would be. Might have killed it when I tried to say it, but this is a very important part of our program. We work with Representative Junkie. We try to be sure we had a representative in every college that needed help, so... I want to hear how that's, if that's going or if it's not going. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Don Pfeiffer. I'm the director of the Higher Education Veterans Program. It's a program of the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. I have quite a team with me today. I'm going to keep my remarks very short because I want you to hear from the people who are impacted by the services that you are helping fund for the state of Minnesota. With me today is Dr. Steve France from the Minnesota State College University System, Dr. Ron Thomas on the end there, and two of the folks that we work very hard with on the campuses, veteran student Patrick Mason and veteran student Heidi Schultz. So we will keep our remarks short. We know you're pressed for time. You do have a handout. I believe it's coming around right now, and this is what I will be making my remarks off of.
Thank you.
It looks like everybody has one. As you know, the Higher Education Veterans Programs was started in July of 2006, and one of the things that was put into that legislation was a sunset date that the program would go out of existence on June 30th, 2011. We're here today to ask for that provision to be removed or changed, because of the impact and the need for services that continues to grow. And you listen to the Adjutant General, and the numbers do not show any sign of decreasing as far as the Minnesota Guard. However, we also work with the reserve units. We also work with returning active duty members, and with some of our programs, we're having worldwide impact, serving Minnesota soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines all over the world. In 2007, through your wisdom, our budget was increased from what it originally was, and so we now operate at a budget slightly over $1 million, and we have operated on that in 2008 to 2009, and next year's budget will be the same. We split the state into six regions. We have 12 coordinators now that are working those regions in addition to myself. We currently have 59 campus veteran centers on all of the different campuses in Minnesota. And this year we had better than 5,000 first-time visitors, and that's literally first-time visitors. We don't tally our second, third, fourth, fifth-time visitors because we don't quite have a very good system that monitors that. But an average student will visit our centers anywhere from 7 to 10 times in a school year. You can see that our number of contacts has increased by almost 50% since last year. A significant portion of that is created by the new Chapter 33, the post-9/11 GI Bill, which is an extremely confusing benefit program that requires individual assistance for everyone who's going to use it. We had an opportunity to work with Guard members at Fort Lewis in Washington for the last 3 weeks. We worked with better than 900 individuals of them. And just about 40% of them came to us for individual counseling about their benefits. And that is what is going to happen as we progress with that particular new GI Bill, where there's transfer options and there's all kinds of variables. We have tremendous partnerships with the University of Minnesota. They offer us space for an office, and they have 6 campus centers. Minnesota State College University System, where they offer us 12 office spaces at their own cost. We don't pay a dime for this, where we have 49 centers. 4 private colleges cooperate with us. Currently, we have had as many as 9, but they kind of flex in and out depending on the number of veterans. Our number one referral source that we refer to are county veteran service officers. Our number 2 is DEED, and that's, of course, jobs and employment. And, of course, we use the community organizations, Minnesota Family Assistance Centers as well. Very, very proud of our Guard partnership. We partner with the Air Guard and the Army Guard with Beyond the Yellow Ribbon activities. We've conducted 35 events for better than 3,500 service members and families this past year. We are also very active with the Air Force Reserve, and also the Army Reserve is now bringing us in to train and provide services for their members. We do a lot of college training and community training, and we have created a www.mymilitaryeducation.org, which is the premier national site for assisting military members and their families as far as benefits and services. And we have a significant number of contacts there, roughly about 3,000 contacts a month from all over the world, ships at sea and foreign countries and wherever our Minnesota military members are serving. One thing we've done is we partnered with other entities in order to make the small amount of dollars we have go further. You can see that based on an average week, coordinators that are paid for through state funds make up, while it's a significant portion of the staffing, you can see that using federal work-study, campus work-study, campuses that employ their own people, volunteers and others, we're able to partner and leverage the resources that you have provided us. And just as a final note, comments, this isn't in your notes, but there is over $62 million coming into Minnesota every year as a result of military or VA benefit payments. And that will probably increase by close to a third once the Chapter 33 is totally implemented. As you know, there's a great large backlog of individuals awaiting the actual payment of their benefits. So with that, I will turn it over to Dr. France.
Senator Vickerman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dr. Stephen France. I'm with the Office of the Chancellor, Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. And Senator Vickerman, you might recall that 4 years ago I was before this committee and I supported this legislation creating the Higher Education Veterans Program. And at that time, I quoted to you a story from NPR about a young veteran who had been injured in 2004. And he had his leg fractured, shattered, and had a large portion of his skull that had been filled in with titanium plates. He had a degree, and he was wanting to come back for retraining. Now, I don't know where he is today, and I don't know if he succeeded, but my concern at that time was, are we ready? And my conclusion was, we were not. We had 2 veteran centers at that time on our campuses. Today, I want to report to you that all of our institutions have at least 1 veteran center, that this was something that was created within our resources, that we did this. Every campus did this because it was the right thing to do, and we now have those. Not every campus has one, but every institution has one in the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. So I think we are more ready today to handle that young man who was from Pierce, Minnesota. Secondly, we were not all members of service member opportunity colleges. That's sort of a good housekeeping seal within higher education and within the military. Military members and veterans see that as an important thing, that if they go to a college that is a service member opportunity college, that's a national designation, that's more a veterans-friendly school. I'm here today to report to you that 100% of Minnesota State Colleges and Universities have that designation today. And we're very proud of that as well. Staff and faculty have been offered training, as you heard Mr. Pfeffer say. We have worked very hard on recognizing credit and honoring the credit for military training. We're not there yet, but we've come a long way in this time. We've done joint programming with the Minnesota National Guard and with the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. And just within the past month, Governor Pawlenty awarded the system status as a yellow ribbon company or a yellow ribbon organization, and we're also very proud of that, and our Board of Trustees accepted that award with great honor. So Minnesota has become a leader in higher education, and we are frequently called upon by other states to talk about the partnership that we have with the Minnesota National Guard and the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. So what difference did the Higher Education Veterans Program do for us? Did they make a difference? And I'm here to argue that I think it was a significant difference. Could this change have happened anyway? Would we have created that number of veteran centers? Well, maybe. But, you know, I don't think so. The Higher Education Veterans Program has been a statewide catalyst for establishing these programs. With people all over the state, we've been able to create veteran centers because we've been able to focus attention on these issues. And we've had these 12 people around the state helping us to focus, helping us to understand what the problems are, and better yet, helping us to resolve the problems. We've increased our veterans' friendliness on campus. They've helped us to change. We provide information on very confusing new regulations, Chapter 33, through their work. I don't think we could have done that. When I talk to higher educators in other states, this is a major, major issue. This new veterans bill is very confusing, and veterans around the country are getting very, very confusing information, and that's not the case in Minnesota. They're getting very clear information from this program. And I hear similar comments also from my colleagues in the University of Minnesota and at private schools as well. I don't represent them, and I'm not speaking for them today. But I do, when I gather with them, I do hear their comments, and their comments are very favorable toward the Higher Education Veterans Program. So it's not just the Minnesota State Colleges and universities. But if I was asked my opinion about how to improve this law, my one suggestion would be to strike the phrase, but no later than June 30th, 2011. We have a sunset clause when the numbers drop down below 4,000, and that then is a need-based clause, a need-based sunset. But having the date 2011, we believe, will artificially stop a program that is so necessary and has helped us become tremendously more veterans-friendly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question. Yes. It's going to sunset, if I read this right, 2011.
Correct.
You know how close that's coming?
Yes, sir, I do.
That's coming very close. Some of us might be someplace else when we need to get some money, but I'm just curious if we should work and try and add a couple years on there so you don't have that tight of a line. A lot of soldiers coming back. There's no jobs out there, and you and I both know that. Takes a little bit longer, so I'm just curious. What do you think,
Senator Vickerman? At a minimum, you need to do that. Please extend the deadline. I'm not sure what the official department policy position on this is, and I'm sure the deputy commissioner will bring that forward. From my perspective, at a minimum, if we could get it extended.
Well, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had one question. I'm confused about. You said all institutions have a veterans center. But not every campus? I'm not sure what you meant by that.
Yes, Senator, I did say that. We have a number of institutions that are multi-campus. So, for example, Minnesota West has 5 campuses. Not all of them might have. In that case, they all do. But there are some institutions where not every campus has a veterans center, but the institution has at least one. So we have them at every institution, but not at. And since we have so few, I didn't want to name those.
Any other questions? If not, let's hear from the rest of
you. Dr. Thomas?
Senator Vickerman, I'm Ron Thomas, for the record, president of Dakota County Technical College, and what a pleasure and honor for me to be here today representing our colleges and also all of the Minsk institutions. I want to share two very quick stories with you. They're both true. Just last week, I spoke with a paratrooper from the 82nd Airborne Division about the vital role of the Veterans Center that is at our college. And I asked him that question, and he turned to me and he said, some of you will know this from the military, we take care of our own. And that's exactly what DCTC is helping us to accomplish through the Veterans Resource Center. I think supporting our U.S. Armed Forces veterans is not just the right thing to do, it is the thing to do. Supporting our vets and their families is our charge, and it's also our obligation. Veterans returning from Iraq and Afghanistan frequently need help with the transition from the war zone to the life stateside. Veterans services at our college and all of the Minsky institutions are all over to help with solutions to that allow veterans to decompress and to get prepared for the future life. One final story I want to share with you is this. We can also help our veterans reach their higher education goals by providing resources they need to flourish. I'm just thrilled every day when I go down to our Student Life Center and I see the veterans there. And I'm going to tell you a little story about something we're going to be doing at our college for the Red Bulls. This is a true story. I'm reminded of a young Marine who was enrolled at our college. And this Marine was highly decorated for his heroic actions that saved the lives of his fellow Marines during an ambush while he was on deployment in Afghanistan. Even after losing his leg below the knee at the outside of the ambush, the young Marine continued to fight until his squad was able to evacuate the kill zone. In his quest to support our vets, we must also work to match the dedication exhibited by this Marine. In that light, we cannot help but succeed. You heard that the Red Bulls are back. They're landing. To show you what happens at our college, 130 students, all 10 faculty members, are sending out emails to all family members who are involved with the Red Bulls and said, come to us, bring your car, we'll check it over for safety check. And if there's anything wrong with your car, we will take care of it. That's the kind of atmosphere we have at our college, and that's the kind of atmosphere we have at all the Minnesota State colleges and universities that serve us, our veterans. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I look forward to any questions or comments that you might have, but it's an honor just to be here today to share some of these comments with you.
Your other two witnesses, let's hear from your young lady.
We told her she might not have to speak.
Senator, you put me on the spot. My name is Heidi Schultz. I've been on two Red Bull tours, and I have 8 years in the Minnesota National Guard. And I can express like how much this program has helped me. At least when I go to the Vet Center at my school, for me personally, and probably for a lot of vets out there, we identify with other veterans because that's what we know, that's what we've been through. So when I can go to that vet center and hang out with my other vets and just talk the talk and, you know, just hang out, I really appreciate it. I feel like it's a place where I can go at school to be at home with my other vets. And not to mention, like, I've run into some obstacles since coming back from my second tour. And I can't tell you how much support I've gotten from this program to, you know, keep going and push through these things that I'm going through. And these people are so incredibly helpful to me. And just from on an individual level, like, I love this program. I think they're great. So thank you, Senator.
Sir. Mr. Chairman and committee, Patrick Mason. I served 4 years in the United States Navy, and I am in active reserve right now. And I'm going to Anoka Ramsey Community College, and I work at the Military Education Resource Center, which is part of the Higher Education Veterans Program. And I can speak as a student. I would not be in college right now if it was not for the help I received from the higher education program. All the veterans at Anoka Ramsey and all the colleges that I went to formed a group that I could go to and talk about what classes I wanted to take and how I could get to that my degree program. And it was the best thing ever. And now that I work at the Merck, I can help veterans do the same thing that they helped me do. And the retention that we get from that is outstanding. We have people come in there every day with questions that the normal counselors at school don't know how to answer. And sometimes when people get set off from little things about other students. They have a place to come in and talk to us about it, and we are able to help each other through all sorts of problems, educational, personal, everything. So my experience with this program is outstanding. Thank you.
Members, are there any questions? Senator Ropes?
Mr. Chair, I don't often get a chance to say go Navy. So I'll take that opportunity.
Oh, yeah.
What could we do to make it better? Are we doing everything we can to make it so that when they come back, somebody hooks up with them so they guide them? Is that working?
Yes, it is. As usual, we are short-staffed. I mean, I have folks that are covering anywhere from 5 to 12, 14 different campuses. They don't complain. They just trog along. The one complaint we will get occasionally is, you weren't here when I needed you. And so we try to connect electronically, but other than short of saying we need more help, there's nothing else. And I know that's not in the picture, sir.
So the best thing we could do is take a look at that sunset date.
Yes, Chairman. That would be a blessing for us if that occurred.
Okay.
And for the people we serve.
Any other questions? I'm sure as we move along through the process, there'll be questions that'll come up, and we'll tackle them as they go along. So thank all of you for coming today.
I don't like to
speed it up too late, but too fast. But I know a lot of you. It's been a long day. And so now we'll move right into the 2010 construction project. Pam Barrels. Welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Vickerman, committee. Pam Barrels, Senior Director, Department of Veterans Affairs for Veterans Homes.
Everett Wright, Facility Program Director for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. What we're going to be referencing today in this presentation is these two items. It's the fact sheet, state program fact sheet, and then the Minnesota Department of Affairs 2010 report to the legislature. The state home construction grant program, the Department of Veterans Affairs provides financial assistance to states to construct and acquire nursing home, domiciliary, adult daycare facilities. The VA may participate in up to 65% of these construction projects. So we the only requirement there is, we need to be state-owned property and operated by the state of Minnesota. I'm going to reference the 2010 report to the legislature construction priority list. We currently have five projects right now, active construction projects employing Minnesota people. Silver Bay Nursing Care space renovation, Burgess Falls 21-bed Alzheimer's Dementia Edition. That one was acquired by the stimulus funding that Obama had signed. Minneapolis Building 9 demo construction and new Building 9. Minneapolis Adult Daycare healthcare renovation in Building 4. And then Hastings Water Replacement. Those five projects bring to the federal dollars into Minnesota close to $34 million. That's 65% of those projects, the cost of those projects. On the 2010 federal VA state home construction grant priority list, this would be projects that grant applications that have been sent in the past that are on our list, priorities 2 through 7. Number 64, this is referencing the 2010 list now, Minneapolis Building 17 resident room upgrade. Minneapolis Resident Building 17 renovation, Minneapolis Kitchen Dining Room renovation, Minneapolis New Chapel, Minneapolis Renovation Phase 2, Minneapolis Building 13, Minneapolis Renovate Building 16, Phase 2. Number 99 is Montevideo grant application, and 110 was Wilmer. None of these that I've just mentioned have the local commitment, the 35% match to any of these projects. So as you can see, you know, the money that needs to come from the state of Minnesota on the 35% would activate any of these projects that you would select. So it's kind of balls in your court, Senator, to, you know, do what you can to support the veterans' nursing homes and our programs. That pretty much is my presentation on that. I'll entertain any questions you may have, Senator.
Well, then there's, right, as we sat here today, there's no approved community for a new home as of right now.
Correct.
I'm going to ask you another question, something I hear in my rural district. We've got nursing homes that would be more than willing to take a veteran in, and that veteran would like to be right close to home. Maybe his wife's got him in town, or maybe she's in there and he lives in town. But in order to do that, we've got to get some kind of a voucher system where somebody has to allow them to use that money to stay in a nursing home. Am I right with that?
Senator Vickerman, currently the VA, federal VA program pays for nursing home care either through the state home grant program, which our veterans' homes are fall under, or private nursing homes, community nursing homes, can contract with the VA in their jurisdiction, which would probably be the Minneapolis VA, for contract nursing home beds. But that's between the community nursing home and the federal VA. That's not anything that we have any control over. That question comes up a lot. Why can't we use unused beds in community nursing homes? And it probably makes sense, but that's something that, you know, maybe we'll have to start working with the out of the box thinking with the federal VA. Right now, we're limited with you know, what they provide, but that doesn't mean we can't look at it in the future and suggest new ideas.
Well, you know, another thing we face, it's easy to build a home, but it costs a lot of money to operate it. That's where we get caught. How do we get that funded? And right now, I don't think there is a way to get that funded. Not from the state, anyway.
Senator, correct. And that's, as far as any future homes that are built, that's a legislative decision. And we're very neutral on that. We will work very hard, you know, if that decision is made, to support that process of going through all the whatever we need to do with the federal VA. But our main concern is to make sure that the current homes that we operate are appropriately funded.
Well, Pam, I've been around quite a few of those the veterans' homes. They're full, aren't they, up to capacity?
Yes, sir. We have waiting lists in all of for all of the skilled homes.
Senator Scoia, do you have a question?
I do, Mr. Chair. You were very cognizant of my thought process here. Back to the question of the funding. If a local nursing home contracts with the VA, is the state responsible then for 100% of the costs of that patient, or do they get to share part of the costs with federal medical assistance money?
Senator, I'm not sure how that process goes. I would imagine it would depend upon the payment abilities of that particular veteran and whether they're receiving Medicaid currently. Mm-hmm. I think the VA, though, would probably cover the cost, but that isn't my expertise.
Okay, thank you. And, Mr. Chair, I have a question on a different subject, which would be back to Mr. Greg. Did I catch your name right?
Mr. Wright.
Mr. Wright?
Right.
I'm sorry. I'm looking at the table 2 on your handout, Community Identification Study for New Minnesota Homes. And you've got the CBOC rank, Little Falls 8, Bonavideo 1.
Correct.
Bemidji number 2.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is it,
my question is, if Bonavideo is number 1 and Bemidji is number 2, what's the stuff on this list where it says Bonavideo and Wilmer? Is that just... I'm kind of curious
Chairman,
how that works.
Senator, the list that I went through with the priority ranking of 64 through 110 is our federal grant application listing. And what you were referencing is a community identification study that was completed this past year, simply ranking any communities that with making sure the resident veteran is taken care of. What communities, what areas, what can we do to provide you legislators information on if you were to select a site for a new veterans home? So this study more or less represents that. And we were simply, required by prioritization to list them 1 through 17. There's 17 communities. This kind of segues into the next presentation that we would have for you about the statewide study. We can possibly answer it then.
Sure, Mr. Chair. If they want to move on, that's fine. I'll see. Maybe they'll answer my question. I'm just on this other handout questions. I see it says the final ranking is based on proximity to the federal VA medical center and the federal VA community-based outpatient clinic. I'm assuming there's a reason that you use that. It has a valid reason.
Correct. What rationale we used there was the CBOC clinics are federally funded clinics that have been placed throughout the state of Minnesota, providing health care clinic appointments to veterans. So that naturally was a plus to have a community operate a CBOC clinic in their area. The other major identifier was the proximity to a VA hospital. A VA hospital will provide clinic appointments plus any surgeries that are needed for veterans, where a CBOC clinic is just clinic appointments and they refer to a VA hospital. So you can see the those two locations or those two institutions were selected as part of this study, the proximity to that for the veterans in our homes.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we had to come up with a final ranking, and this is going into the next presentation, but I participated in on that also. And because all 17 communities really fit the major issues that we wanted to see, that any community, if you decided to add any veterans nursing homes, would have, we had to come up with a final priority ranking. And based on our experience, the relationship that we have with the VA hospitals is very important. They provide a lot of support for the homes, and we felt that was the most important relationship. And secondarily, having a CBOC provided a lesser relationship with the VA, but still a very important relationship. So we created almost a 2-to-1 ranking in that proximity to come up with final ranking.
Mr. Chair, well, when the people are coming up to, you're going to move on your presentation, I'll just say, I think your ranking probably has validity, and I don't represent Bemidji, but I represent a large area of the northwest corner of the state. And a couple of years ago, if you want to recall, committee members, we had a couple of maps of service areas, and there's a whole big blob of white up there that there's needs that just aren't being addressed. So I think maybe your rank has some validity, and I'm glad to see that number there.
Chairman, if I might, if you have no further questions for the construction priority list, we'll segue right into our next presentation.
Is that lady?
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dennis Devereaux. I'm the legal analyst for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, and I'm going to speak in regard to the community identification study for siting a new Minnesota Veterans Home, and I'm referring to these handouts, which I believe you have. Approximately a year ago, Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs conducted a competitive process. We issued an RFP to choose a consultant to do a community identification study. Now, this study was not done to direct that a home be built in any particular community, or even that a home be built at all. That's a decision that is done through the legislative process, House, Senate, Governor. The purpose of the study was to identify those factors, those criteria, which are most important to consider when the question of where and if we are going to construct a new state veterans home. First and foremost in consideration is the ability to get federal financial participation. The U.S. Veterans Administration Construction Grant Program will provide up to 65% of the cost of a new state veterans home. And they have certain criteria that must be met. The most important in relation to siting a home is that there must be a minimum separation distance between existing state veterans' homes. We looked at that as most primary consideration in looking at which communities where this could be sited. Second to that is proximity to a VA, federal VA medical center, or a community-based outpatient clinic. And thirdly, the availability of a local acute care hospital in the communities. We did overlay maps for the state of Minnesota through the consultant and came up with 27 communities that met these three mandatory criteria. Next, we looked at demographic and operational considerations. That is, we looked at the number of veterans in those communities that could be served. We looked at a minimum of 10,000 veterans and active National Guard members. We looked at the availability of medical staffing, that is, registered nurses, LPNs, certified nursing assistants, and other medical personnel, doctors, dentists, psychologists, psychiatrists, and did the overlay maps for those three criteria and came up with a final list of 17 communities that met all those criteria. Any one of these 17 communities would be a suitable location for a state veterans home. Now, as was mentioned before, to determine the final ranking, we looked at the most important consideration, our partnership with the federal VA medical centers and the federal community-based outpatient clinics. We looked at the distance to each of these facilities of each of these 17 sites, ran it through the formula, and came up with a ranking, 1 through 17. Now, in conclusion, the study was not done to identify any particular one of these 17s where a home should be built or if a home should be built at all. It was done to lay the parameters to set forth rational criteria where such a decision could be evaluated and made. We looked at federal financial consideration, the number of local veterans needing services, and then adequate trained medical personnel available to provide those services. That's my presentation today. I'd be happy to entertain questions.
Well, I think what people have to understand, there's a difference between a veterans hospital and a veterans home. They're not the same. They kind of get them mixed in together, but there is a great difference between them. I think I could look down here, and I think every one of us would like to have a new home in our district. I can tell you that. But right now, if maybe you can't tell me, maybe you can. Is there any priority list whatsoever for a veteran's home in this state?
Chairman,
at this particular time.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs is totally neutral on this issue. We have just done this in order to frame the discussion, to get the issues out there that this committee and this body needs to consider when they make that decision.
Okay. Senator Deal.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Devereaux, where do I find that list of 17 cities? It's in this book here, I guess.
Yes, I believe you do have it. It's a study. It's on our website for anyone to peruse.
Second to last page. Mr. Chair, Senator, if you have this study, it's the second to the last page.
Senator Dill, do you find...
I found it.
We got time.
Senator Dill is. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. While Senator Dill is looking over that priority list, can I ask a question on the priority project list? On the back page of this, it shows the 2010 federal VA State Home Construction Grant priority list. And noticing number 99 and 110 are for the new nursing home construction in Montevideo and Wilmer, and it says that that's on priority level 2 through 7. Say the 35% match was achieved either locally or through the state for that our share of the construction dollars, and that either one of those projects or any of these projects was moved to the priority 1 list, where would they rank or how would they be ranked on that priority 1 list? Would these numbers that we're seeing here change?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, they would. They would change. The federal VA prioritizes annually those applications on their list, and it's based on the life safety. If a state has never had any construction grant for a nursing home, and then it goes by. The amount of beds, the VA has determined the total number of nursing home beds for each state. And based on the total number of beds each state has, they either have a great need, a moderate need, or a low need. And so that would be a further ranking. Or if it's a renovation. So they have kind of a decision tree that they use to rank these projects. So even if you were in priority one on a given year and there's not enough funding to cover all of those projects, and say you were 25 on that priority one list, but there wasn't enough money to fund that project, the next year that might even drop down lower or be higher, depending upon how they do their ranking. And the total amount of dollars each year that the federal government puts into that program for funding.
Thank you for that. And, Mr. Chairman, can you describe for us what a safety priority would be? What would rank higher than probably a new construction like this? Or what type of issues are the federal government looking at spending their money on in that priority one list?
Chairman, Senator, on the life safety prioritization, they take into consideration projects like sprinkler systems, generator replacements, those kind of items that are very crucial to operation of a veterans home. You know, anything that is a life safety type definition. And so when we send it in, if there is some of that in the package, then we identify that to them and ask them to consider it as a life safety project. For instance, just as an example, we did our Building 9 that the legislature funded 35% in 08, and that was we had to demo the Building 9 on the Minneapolis campus, and that was a life safety structural deficiency. So that one, upon providing the documentation to the feds and the new application for the replacement and asking for life safety consideration, it came back with a rating of number 2 nationwide because the building needed to be demoed. We couldn't use it for our veterans anymore, so we had to demo the building. So that's an example of the life safety.
Senator Dale, you still have a question?
I'm good, thank you.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you. Could I move to the demographics and operational analysis table that's in this handout? I have a little question about how you calculate kind of areas of service, I guess. And the first thing that came to my mind is I'm looking at this and I see both Hibbing and Virginia are on this list, but when you think about that as an area, it's those quad cities up there. Shouldn't those two communities kind of be combined for a cumulative score? Because they're certainly going to serve all the same communities.
Mr. Chair, Senator, when we were identifying communities in this study, we looked at city limits. We looked at individual communities and not metropolitan areas, so to speak. So certainly those communities are very close and together would constitute a municipal area. But for the purpose of the study, we looked at individual distinct cities.
Well, Mr. Chair, that really seems unreasonable considering the vast rural nature of much of this area. What about all the people that don't live in a city?
Mr. Chair, Senator, in doing the analysis, we went by zip code and took into account the rural areas around each community in determining veteran population, and also the availability of trained medical personnel. So it did take into consideration the rural areas.
Well, Mr. Chair, I have to make a complaint to your study's premises. I represent Senate District 2. The largest community in that Senate district is 3,200 people. So that entire Senate district, none of those people would count in this analysis of service of vets, even though there's thousands of veterans in my Senate district. It seems like you're leaving a lot of people unserved with that analysis.
Mr. Chair, Senator, there are limits to any analysis, and any type of home servicing a number of veterans needs to look at the concentration of veterans and the concentration of services available. And in some instances, sparsely populated areas may not get the consideration they deserve in that type of study.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senate District 2 contains the same number of people as Senate districts that have more concentrated populations, but you're excluding them from your analysis, and that doesn't seem reasonable to me. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
It's true.
Any other questions? I have a question. The one Senate paper they're looking at building in, I think it's Elk River. That's a kind of a psychiatric hospital or something, isn't it? That isn't a nursing home.
Mr. Chair, there's a community-based outpatient clinic there, a federally operated. Yes.
Okay. Any other questions? Senator Ropes?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Scoy, following your thinking there, wouldn't the same you run into the same problem dealing with zip codes then as a way to be looking at population centers? How many zip codes are in your Senate district?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Erickson Ropes, I mean, I don't know, but there has to be 50 or, I mean, maybe 100. I don't know. I've got at least 20-plus communities, and they will all would have independent
different
zip
ones.
Codes.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's Leonard and Debs and all these little burgs, and they all have their independent zip codes. I don't know how many there are, but there's lots and lots of them. And those people would be serviced by one of these more regional centers, but they're not being counted in this analysis, even though that's where their medical care would come from.
Mm-hmm.
And all of these travel times, which I think this is good to look at this, but all that travel time would apply to them too. They just aren't being counted because they don't live within a city zip code. I think it's a complete misreading of the character of rural Minnesota to just look at the people that live inside a city, a boundary of a city.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair,
questions?
Senator, we looked. I'm not sure I understand, because we looked at the entire population. We didn't look just inside cities to come up with cities that would be appropriate. We looked at when they looked at the demographics, they looked at the whole all of the counties. We started with counties. So I'm not sure if I'm understanding.
Mr. Chair and Ms. I'm so terrible with names, I can't even remember.
Barrows.
What I heard him say is when you were doing this analysis that got to this graph, it was done by city boundary. I'm pretty sure I heard him say that, and by zip code. But it goes back to the original question with regard to Virginia, Eveleth, Hibbing, and Bowabic. Those are called the quad cities. Two of them are on the list. Now, if you're going to provide services to the quad cities, you would count them all in one service area because they're all within, I mean, I don't know how many miles, and I don't represent that area, but it's pretty close. So as a common sense analysis of it, you would look at that as one service area. It would make sense to me. And I asked the question, and he said, well, we did it by city boundary and zip code. And so that led me to conclude that if you were outside a city boundary or zip code, you would be excluded from the analysis. I don't know what other conclusion I would draw from that.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we in certain of the demographics, we looked at the individual city limits, such as an acute care hospital. In most of the other demographics relating to veterans population and the availability of trained medical personnel, we started out on a county basis and went by zip code. So we did include the the rural areas of the various communities. So it was a mixed criteria relating to those factors.
Follow-up?
I'm fine. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mayor Lurie?
I'd like to just make sure I understand, because I'm trying to track here. I think you just said, you know, should it be in Virginia or Eveleth, and that when you do that, you say, okay, here's Virginia, and we're going to count all the veterans or National Guard members. We're going to go out 60 minutes from the city, and any county that that catchment area touches, all of the veterans in that county goes to that city. And so when you do Virginia and Eveleth, I mean, you're talking largely the same population of veterans would count towards both cities. So, I mean, if I'm understanding correctly, you're going to be a few minutes different from one of the hospitals. You're going to be a few minutes different from one of the outpatient clinics. But so the distinctions between those two cities may be very minimal, but you just did it. You just did the analysis based on a center point of one city or the other. Am I correct in that? Is that okay?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes.
Senator?
And just for clarification, Mr. Chairman, there may be a graph that's not shown here because I think I've seen it on other reports where you actually drew the circles that showed the catchment areas, right? Isn't that correct? Is there more to this report that, because like Senator Lurie said, they took the city and drew a catchment area 50 miles or something like that, roughly 45 minutes an hour from that point. And I think that would have been made it a little bit more clear for you, Senator Skoy, had you seen that.
Yeah, right. Mr. Chair and Senator Gimsey, that's exactly the map that I was referring to that we were presented with a couple of years ago. And when you looked at that map, the entire northwest corner of the state, they were no services. You know, so, I mean, 60 minutes is a good number, but it's probably not the all-encompassing number if you live 70 minutes from a regional center. I know you got to draw lines and you got to do things. I mean, that's the way the world works. But I'm laying foundation for making an argument here.
And you're doing it well.
Any other questions? Todd, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now we're going to move into something we probably really don't like to talk about, but we're going to, and that's the new vet cemetery.
I like to talk about that.
I don't mind talking about it.
Yeah, me either.
Senator Vickerman, I like to talk about that.
Somebody's asking questions.
I've been busy all summer talking about that.
We've tossed this veteran cemetery around here all last year. Did look at two spots.
Get a lot of votes from the cemetery area.
So we'd like to hear from you.
Thinking about it.
What progress have we made? And I see there's Little Falls and there's Duluth, Redwood. There's different areas. So maybe you could start out and give us some information.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, for the record, my name is David Swantek. I'm the cemetery director at the State Veterans Cemetery in Little Falls. For fiscal year 09, I first provide you an update on what we've done at our existing cemetery, which has been in operation since the summer of 1994. In that time, since 1994 through the end of the fiscal year 09, we've provided burials for 3,146 veterans, their eligible spouses, and dependents. Fiscal year 09, we did 282 total burials. 189 of those were veterans, 93 were spouses and dependents. One of the veterans that is in that list is also on page 4 of this report. And his parents that day was their only child. And I talked to them before they left. We were able to get a headstone in place at that grave in 3 days. So there was a headstone marking that grave when that family came into the cemetery. We presented them with a presidential memorial certificate that day that General Shelato presented to them. And the last thing those parents said to me was, please take good care of my son. And that's a profound responsibility that we take, and we're honored to do that on a daily basis. As you know, we discussed last year the possibility of two additional state veterans cemeteries in Minnesota, one in the Duluth area and also one in southwest Minnesota in Redwood County. The National Cemetery Administration also does a priority list of pending cemetery construction grant projects. And for fiscal year 2010, the Redwood County project is ranked number 14 out of 60 projects, and the Duluth area is ranked number 15 out of 60 projects. The priority list includes essentially two types of projects, expansion and improvement projects, and then the second is establishment of new cemeteries. If you eliminate the first 10 projects on the current list for fiscal year 10, and that's federal fiscal year 10, the first 10 projects on that list are for expansion and improvement projects, typically smaller dollar amounts for those grants, but they're essential projects to keep existing cemeteries in operation. So those take a priority one on the priority group listing. So for the establishment of new cemeteries, the first one on the list is at number 11. So putting the Redwood project at number 14 places that on number 4 on the list for establishment of new cemeteries. And number 5 on the list is the Duluth area project. This is very good news for our projects. They're ranked very high in these establishment projects. And they're all indications are that these projects can be funded. It's just a matter of us obtaining a final site for the construction of the project. Again, the grant program, the federal grant program, provides 100% of the construction cost of the project. The state is responsible for the upfront design costs, which an appropriation last year was included for both of these projects, so that money is in place. Once that money is expended and the project has been funded for construction, the federal government actually reimburses the state back the cost for that design work. So essentially the project becomes 100% funded by the federal government, minus any land acquisition costs. Where are we at with site acquisition in these two areas? Duluth area, of course, is something that we've been working on for the past couple of years. We've searched essentially from an area north of Duluth down to the very northern part of Carlton County. As you may recall, we had identified through a search with the DNR a piece of property on the southern edge of Jay Cook State Park that we thought was going to work for a cemetery. As it turned out, after the session last year, we had an access problem into that property. The existing access was too narrow for what we needed for an entryway, and we were unsuccessful in negotiating with the adjacent landowners to allow us to acquire a small strip of land to widen that access. We had one neighbor who was essentially opposed to the project, another neighbor that used his 40 acres for hunting and didn't really want to give up his hunting preserve that was right to the back of 9,000 acres in Jay Cook State Park. We formally identified 12 sites for consideration in that region, and those sites have been brought forward to us by both the DNR and both St. Louis and Carlton counties. We've worked through a criteria list that we have from the National Cemetery Administration, and the things that we look at when we're determining site selection is proximity to the densest veteran population that we're looking to serve, the size of the property, the shape, is it uniform in shape, is it accessible by a major highway, is there any utilities available, surrounding land use, soils, topography, those type of things are what we look at. It's not just any site that will work for a cemetery. Northeast Minnesota, that region has provided us a tremendous challenge. There's some very unique geology that exists in that region. It's either a lot of bedrock, swamp, what have you. The county identified pieces have essentially been tax forfeit property in that region, and for the most part, those properties have proved to be unsuitable. There's probably a reason somebody stopped paying taxes on those pieces of property. We have executed a design contract with an engineering firm in the Twin Cities area. That contract was executed just last month, and it is for design of both these new proposed facilities. The firm comes to us with expansive experience. They just recently completed the $25 million expansion project at Fort Snelling. So the team is very, very versed in the requirements of the National Cemetery Administration, and we're fortunate to have them as a local firm that we were able to tap into their experience on a project that they just finished. We'll be utilizing them to help us with those difficulties of site suitability that we're finding, especially in the Northeast region. And we're excited to have them on board to assist us with this. We think we can more effectively look for a potential site in that area and get this project rolling. Redwood County, a different story in southwest Minnesota. Essentially agriculture land. We were required by the language last year to look for donated property to start with. We did put out an appeal in that region for donations of suitable cemetery property from May of last year through the end of September 2009. And through that effort, we received one offer of a donation. It was near the community of Wabasso. And we looked at the property, did some initial simple analysis, and immediately determined that there was a fairly high water table on the property, and there was a pretty significant irrigation canal that ran through the whole property, basically cut it in half with this irrigation canal. So, you know, we certainly formally thanked the gentleman for his offer. It was the only one that we had received, but respectfully declined and outlined the issues that would impact that property negatively. We also worked with the DNR in that region to identify any state-owned property that may exist down there. Again, vast differences between the two regions. There just nothing popped up with the DNR that wasn't locked up in some kind of conservation role or a wildlife management area or something that, you know, would want to or could reverse a use for that property. So, at the end of September, we've really deemed that search for donated property unsuccessful. And through that same time, we had been receiving some inquiry about property that may be for sale in the area. And five sites have been identified to us as being potentially available for purchase. Some of them were on the market for sale. Others were not properties that were even considered to be for sale, except for the property owner's interest in this project. So we are currently evaluating those sites, and we'll make a determination on moving forward with an appraisal on what site shakes out to be the highest ranking site according to the criteria that I shared here today. Once we do that, you know, we look to move forward quickly with acquiring that property so we can get our team that is in place on the fast track of designing. We anticipate funding for the projects. We anticipate funding for the Redwood County project in fiscal year 11, federal fiscal year 11. And then the following year, we would anticipate funding for the Duluth area project. That gives us a little bit more time to kind of sort out what we got going in the Northeast region. So at this time, it appears that the Southwest project will take place first, followed up very closely by the Northeast project. The good news is the ranking on the priority list. We're very high on that list, so we feel very fortunate where we're at with that. As a final comment, point of interest, we have received an inquiry this fall from Fillmore County in southeast Minnesota. We attended a county commissioners meeting in Fillmore County in November and kind of explained an overview of how this works and, you know, what how we could see they could assist us possibly with another cemetery down in that area. There is population down there that would support a grant for that region as well. And, you know, we'll continue to work with Fillmore County, and they have some property that they've identified. They're not sure what they want to do with it. It was for sale at one point, but we're still in talks with them. So that's something that may be up and coming of interest for you. I guess with that, I'd be happy to take questions.
How many acres? What are we talking about? 40, 80, 160? Yeah, a certain size?
Yeah, Senator Vickerman, committee members, we would we first came out and said 40 usable acres. That created some confusion for a lot of folks, and we've kind of modified that to say 60 to 120 acres. Senator Vickerman, in your area, we could probably get 40 acres and all 40 would be usable, but Senator Lori's district, we may need 200 acres to get 40 usable. So, you know, we're saying 60 to 120 acres is what we want to see for proposed property size.
I'll say this about both areas. There are people out there, if they have the knowledge, that donate. There's some very wealthy people out in all parts. They're getting no children, getting home, wanting to know what to do with the property. So we need to kind of look at that. But the reason that I thought was pushed to have one someplace other than in the cities, people I represent out there are scared to death to drive up here. And that isn't fair for a soldier who should have a nice place to be buried. So that's kind of, I think, what we're trying to do. I'd like to build four or five of them. I helped build the one in Little Falls. That's really moved ahead. I'm going to shut up in a minute, but I want to ask you another question. Other than this, who takes care of it? Do we have to have a county or the city or after it's built? Let's just say it's built.
Sure.
There's got to be mowing and there's got to be markers and there's...
Senator Vickerman, committee members... We have a staff at the Little Falls facility, which I supervise. We currently have a staff of 5 employees at the cemetery. That is one requirement for this federal grant, is that the state agrees to operate the facility into perpetuity. So there are tails to these projects. You know, we don't require a large staff, but there's a lot of important work that takes place at our facility. It's nothing compared to a veteran's home, but... Yet there will be a requirement for a state-employed staff or a state appropriation, if you will, to operate these cemeteries after they're ready to operate.
Well, I really didn't want a cemetery right beside of a veteran's home, because that's bad enough if they're in the veteran's home. I know what they'll think. So we're going to stay away from that. I can tell you that. Stenerdale.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, I just thought of a story which is kind of on this subject, but not, it doesn't really connect up too well. But I had a neighbor who was a retired U.S. Army major, and he hired me to do his square baling for his hay for several years in a row. And one time I didn't get it done before it rained, and he got so mad that he said that after I die and get cremated, I'm going to have the pilot fly over my farm and drop the ashes on my farm, and then he's going to fly over your farm and drop the urn on your head.
Sir Lori.
So thank you, Senator Vickerman, and I'd just like to welcome Dave Swantek back. I've been on several tours of northeastern Minnesota with him. I am intimately aware of the challenges our region places on endeavors. I do try to farm on some of those geologically challenged areas, and but our veterans live there because they love this area too, and so I really applaud you for coming up and staying focused on making sure that we can continue to move forward with this project. I wanted to ask, are there still 12 sites? Are there 12 sites identified now that are potentials still? Or I know we had gotten down to a number much smaller than that, and I'd gone and looked at some of those with you.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Senator Lurie, 12 sites was the total number that we've looked at since the inception of the idea, five of which were within Jay Cook State Park. The remaining seven were identified between St. Louis and Carlton County, essentially the tax forfeit pieces.
So they're pretty much the same ones that you and I have gone over.
Yes.
The top two the last time we looked are still the top two. Is that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Lurie, the two that we're kind of identifying as, that we're continuing to evaluate are the two. As I said, with the A&E team in place now,
Yes. The
technical challenges that exist, they're much more prepared to help us with that. At the end of the day, I'm a cemetery director. I'm not an engineer. I'm not an architect. I've done this for a long time, but I need their assistance to carry this work out.
Absolutely. Thank you for the clarification.
Any other questions? Senator Oakes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to thank Mr. Swantek and Deputy Commissioner Puglisi for coming down to Preston earlier this year. And we have some beautiful rolling bluffs down there that we're looking at. There are no commitments on any of the parties' sides at this point. We're still trying to negotiate details. But the county board for Fillmore County is very interested in potentially donating a certain amount of acreage and working in partnership with the state to have the project moving forward. And just to let committee members know, we've had great support from the state as we've had lots of questions and are trying to move through the process. And I will probably be bringing a couple of pieces of legislation to this committee to help us move forward.
Okay, members, we need to move along because it's getting late. Thank you very much. We'll try and work on this. Ms. Barrels, will you come up again? We're going to go into Veterans Health Care. And I wonder if we shouldn't have both of you up at the same time, quality control and something we're kind of looking at. Well, something we're looking at. Nobody's falling out of bed anymore and breaking their legs, are they? Don't need that either. Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Pam Barrels, Senior Director of Veterans Health Care, Department of Veterans Affairs.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Robin Gausted, and I'm the Director of Quality Services for the Minnesota Veterans Home. And I'm here this afternoon to talk with you about the Medicare and Medicaid feasibility study and where we are at this point with that study. Your handout looks like this. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the methodology that we used when we approached the study. And I'm going to talk to you a little bit about some of our findings and where we are today in terms of next steps. We also utilized a request for proposal process and ended up contracting with an organization called Affinity Health Services. We did that early last year, first quarter, and they joined us at the table in May and finished up their work in early November. In terms of the project itself, we actually completed the project in three phases in terms of the feasibility study to look at the Minnesota Veterans Homes and the opportunity around that to become Medicare and Medicaid certified in the Minnesota Veterans Homes. The first phase really entailed data gathering, and we developed some templates and some checklists and utilized that to collect information from all five of our veterans' homes. The first phase of that identified the costs per patient day at each of our homes. So it was a lot of data gathering, a lot of look at information, both financial information, census information, length of stay, acuity, et cetera. As we gathered that information, we tried to realign that financial information to align with the way a Medicare-certified community-based skilled facility would approach financial analysis and the development of what we call a cost report, which is required by Medicare for nursing homes that become Medicare certified. So our goal was to align our financial accounting with that same process and that same structure. We then established a basis for being able to determine the Minnesota Veterans Home's financial impact for the study. So that was phase one. There were no findings from that. It was more analysis of information and gathering of information. And each of the homes spent a lot of time on that, actually. The second phase of our methodology actually came in two parts. So you'll see that there was a phase 2A and a phase 2B. In phase 2A, we looked at the analysis of then operational considerations for the Minnesota Veterans Homes if we would become Medicare certified. We had to look at several key areas. One of the first key areas that is crucial in terms of understanding the Minnesota Veterans Homes versus community-based Medicare certified homes is the admission process and our waiting lists. And obviously you folks know that we have rules and regulations that define our admission criteria and our waiting list process. Those do not occur in community-based facilities. They utilize marketing plans and advertising and what have you to attract residents and families. Another one of the key points that we soon found is that the Minnesota Veterans Homes have many fewer admissions because we have much longer lengths of stays than our counterparts in the community. And our counterparts in the community-based certified Medicare nursing homes have a very high turnaround in terms of lengths of stay and numbers of residents that they serve. And that's very much connected to the Minnesota Veterans Home's mission. Our mission is really to serve our veterans in a long-term healthcare setting. When veterans come to our homes, typically they see that as the place that they're going to stay for many, many years. In community-based nursing homes that are Medicare certified, they're looking at very short lengths of stay. They have very acutely ill residents, and it's their goal to turn those admissions around quickly for billing purposes to enhance revenue. One of the early findings that you may have seen in the report that Deputy Commissioner Acevedo circulated a couple of weeks ago was that our waiting list process in the Minnesota Veterans Homes and our admission criteria practically eliminates the ability of our veterans homes to admit residents directly from hospitals, taking advantage of the 3-day hospital stay requirement that's necessary to become and be able to utilize Medicare Part A benefits. Medicare Part A requirements via CMS are threefold. You must meet skilled nursing or skilled rehab acute care needs with a high acuity based on acute illness or injury. And those skilled services can only be provided in a skilled nursing facility. So we have to meet those criteria for Medicare payments for nursing homes that are community-based, that are Medicare certified. And that's a pretty important piece because that's very different than the admission criteria for our veterans homes. In terms of our findings, after the analysis in Phase 2A, we found that, again, our admission practices for the Minnesota Veterans Homes vary significantly from what we would find in the community and in industry norm. Our discharge planning practices also vary very significantly, and the reason that that's important is, again, because our community-based colleagues that are Medicare certified have a very high turnover rate, and their goal for that turnover rate is really to enhance billing and therefore revenue. Our lengths of stay vary significantly as well. In the Minnesota Veterans Homes, our lengths of stay are often years and decades. In the community-based Medicare-certified homes, it's typically months. Very different kind of approach to care and populations that they serve. Our therapy services and our therapy service levels also vary very significantly. The Minnesota Veterans Homes provides more rehab and more therapy to residents than you'll find commonly in a community-based home. And again, the community-based home wants to be able to treat those more acutely ill residents who have acute care needs or acute skilled needs for rehab services. So we're looking at, in the Veterans Home, providing rehab services based on clinical need, whereas in the community, they're looking at the billing potential for providing those rehab services. And those rehab services are defined in terms of rules and regs and billing criteria. Our documentation processes also vary quite significantly. At the Minnesota Veterans Homes, we document based on care needs of residents. That's our documentation is based on reflecting the care needs of our residents. In the community, they're really looking at documentation to be able to maximize payment and revenue. And that's just the way that that process works. We also found that our business and accounting processes vary significantly as well. At the Minnesota Veterans Homes, we have less complex data systems, and our accounting practices are much more streamlined and straightforward, whereas in the community-based system, because they're compelled to provide cost reports and a lot of compliance information relative to billing practices, they have to have a totally different kind of billing system and computer system that backs that up. In terms of our second phase, our second part of our second phase, 2B, we also analyzed our financial and business office operations. It was critical for us because our operations vary significantly from what you'll find in the community in a Medicare-certified facility. Our key considerations were our accounts receivable and our billing policies and procedures. The Minnesota Veterans Homes use as a cost of care calculation versus billing of third-party payers, and we also needed to assess our computer and our billing system applications because they're quite different than what you find in the community. And our findings actually verified all of that. Our general ledger and accounting systems vary significantly. Ours at the Minnesota Veterans Homes are quite simple and straightforward versus a more complex system. Our business office accounting system and policies vary significantly as well. Because we use a cost of care calculation instead of third-party billing, we have different requirements relative to billing. And so there's significant variation there as well. And then, again, our computer systems. Finally, the part that you're probably most interested in is so what? What was the cost-benefit? What kinds of assumptions and analysis could we derive from a cost-benefit analysis, and what's the so what relative to implementation? In order to figure that out, we had to do three or four kinds of further analysis. One of those was a gap analysis. We took the conditions of participation, which are the CMS rules and regs, and we did mock surveys and life safety code audits at each of our facilities. So I actually accompanied our consulting team. We spent a week at each of our facilities and conducted those mock surveys and life safety code analysis. We also then looked again in further detail at expenses, and we looked at our expenses in two ways, and this is kind of an important piece in that it gets us to the methodology around the ranges of opportunity. The first way we looked at expense was looking at a cost per resident day using current Minnesota Veterans Home information. So we used actual Minnesota Veterans Homes expense data. The second way we looked at expenses was using the consulting company Affinity's database. They had a national database, plus they looked at some information specific to Minnesota, and they took our information and, again, analyzed it and changed it to meet more community-based standard or norms, and that created the high range of potential opportunity. For revenue, we used the Medicare-Medicaid rates. We used, for the Minnesota Veterans Homes, our maintenance fees and our federal per diems, and also then looked at our actual patient days. So in terms of analysis, we looked at, in the final review, we developed two scenarios. And the first scenario was actually an analysis and summary of the cost-benefit for the Minnesota Veterans Homes if they pursue Medicare certification with no change, and that's an important piece, with no change to our current admission criteria and waiting list rules. However, the conclusion of the review of that scenario demonstrated that three of our four nursing homes would not benefit from Medicare Part A programming under the current admission criteria and discharge model that we use, but that we could potentially benefit from Medicare Part B and Medicare Part D in those homes. And that's an important finding for us to pause and think about. The second scenario was an analysis and summary of the cost-benefit for the Minnesota Veterans Homes to pursue Medicare certification by seeking revision of our admission criteria and waiting list rules. The result of that, however, and the reason that I started this discussion by talking about our mission and the difference between our mission and the mission of a community-based Medicare-certified facility, is that we feel, and I think it's demonstrated by the way we implement the Minnesota Veterans Homes, that we're here to serve the long-term needs of our veterans, therefore our residents and families. We see it and have now operationalized our Minnesota Veterans Homes to be long-term living arrangements, very different from a short-term, rapid turnaround community-based facility. So what we did was developed a range of financial assessment so that instead of at the end of the study coming up with, quotes, a number, because it's so complex and because there are so many variables and assumptions that went into the study, we developed the two models that gave us a range of financial assessments. So for those of you who spent a little bit more time looking at the study and the recommendations and the findings, you noticed that there was a low and a high range. That low range, again, was for our homes as they operate now, making no changes to our admission criteria and our waiting list. So it's based on our current acuity mix and our current length of stay. An acuity mix for most of our facilities that's lower than what you'll find in a community-based Medicare-certified home and a length of stay that's much longer. The high end of that range demonstrates an opportunity if we revise our admission process and our waiting list, which would create the need for a rules change and would significantly change our mission. So in summary, in terms of phase three, which is really kind of the meat of the report that talks about what is the opportunity and what would an implementation plan look like, in order to proceed in terms of some level of implementation, we would need investment costs for Medicare certification that would be relative to the implementation plan. So what does that mean? That means that there will be, in order to implement some level of Medicare certification, we're going to have some upfront costs and one-time expenditures, and then we'll have some ongoing costs on an annual basis. We'll need some consulting time to support our needs for implementation. We're in the process of developing an RFP to describe that consulting time. We'll need some computer software and hardware equipment. We have lots of training needs for staff, both skilled needs in terms of clinical skills and HIPAA compliance for confidentiality and ongoing Medicare compliance needs. And, of course, we need to develop systems, policies, and procedures. Where are we now? We have a team that has been working actually quite hard since last year on the implementation of Medicare Part D, and we're currently working very hard at pursuing those options. We're looking at a centralized pharmacy, we're looking at remote dispensing, and we're looking at being able to change our billing processes around Medicare Part D. In terms of Medicare Parts A and B, we are fine-tuning and assessing the feasibility and cost benefits separately for each home based on the merits for each home, and we're doing the same for Medicaid. Our goals as an agency and as the Minnesota Veterans Homes are to move forward with a phased approach that positions us for both short and long-term success, so we're trying to be very thoughtful about that, however, move along expeditiously. And our goal is to honor the military service of our veterans and the needs of our residents and families as we've been serving them currently and over the past many years. So with that, I'll pause. I know that's a lot of information, and I apologize for that.
Senator Roach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Gusta, thank you very much for this report on your methodology. It's clear that the mission of the Veterans Home is very distinct and different from the typical nursing home out there, I think. And yet I have the question about when you were comparing yourself to the industry standard, it's not every nursing home that really markets itself for the acute patient coming in, rotating in and out, you know, high billing. Not every nursing home acts as a step-down unit from hospitals, really. So to what extent did you look at other models out there? Because I know in my district, a lot of my nursing homes really do function the way the Minneapolis Veterans Home do. Just they're a long-term care site. They might have a couple beds dedicated to acute care and high acuity levels and in and out. But there's a lot of long-term patients there that, you know, as you're describing, have low acuity mix and a long-term, you know, length of stay. So can you tell me a little bit what was that standard, or how did you get to that when you're talking about the industry standard?
Mr. Chair, Senator, actually, quite frankly, I didn't, and we didn't at the Minnesota Veterans Homes. Our staff didn't make those comparisons. I probably said the royal we. But Affinity Health Services, because they're a nationally known consulting company, researched both Minnesota averages and compared us to Minnesota averages as well as to national averages as well as to other national other veterans homes who are also Medicare certified. So they looked at all three of those databases as well as ourselves. Okay. And your point is extremely well taken.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions?
I have one more. Thank you. And then I'm not surprised, and probably there's a lot of real pleased people about the results here.
But can you remind me, in the very beginning, when we were first having this conversation about looking into potentially becoming Medicare certified, I know there was a lot of resistance to that and concern. Can you help me remember what some of that concern was?
I think, Mr. Chair, Senator, I don't want to speak for, you know, everyone that's kind of out there that may have shared concerns, but I think that internally and our staff probably had concerns relative probably more to our mission and how would a change like that impact our mission. Concern for the fact that we do have veterans who have lived in our homes for many, many years, literally decades, and a concern that we would change our mission from being resident-centered and concerned about that long-term relationship with our veterans to this more, we need shorter lengths of stay, we could change our admission criteria, we could change our mission and go down a different path. And I think it was out of respect for the tradition and for the mission that I heard a lot of the concern. But I have to say that in terms of the process, the way the homes, every one of them stepped up, were very welcoming of the consultants and were 150% cooperative. Everything that was required or requested, everything was opened up, and I would say that I was very pleased with the way the staff and our folks responded.
Any other questions? Any follow-up by Ms. Barrows?
Mr. Chair, members, we just want to thank you very much for the support that you've given our veterans' homes and the Department of Veterans Affairs, and we very much appreciate it. Thank you.
Members, if you ever get a chance to get down to Laverne, walk down the aisle, you'll see a picture of a cat, and there's no crossing. And that house, can a cat tell you're not supposed to go there? Pam says they know how to, they stop at that thing. Okay, with that, I apologize to members for keeping so long, but it was Veterans Day today, and we wanted to kind of get this out of the way. So thanks very much for all of you for your patience, and we're adjourned.
Glad to be there.